With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, we have this week's Almond Update, which is reflecting on 20 years of ABC leadership with Richard Wacott. But our top story today, we continue our look back on 2023 with Director of Government and Public Affairs with the Ag Business Advisory Company, Pinion, Brian Keel. In the first part of the series, he said trade got negative marks for the year. However, there were some trade successes.
One thing the Biden administration did that was great and that we support, they announced a $1.3 billion regional ag promotion program paid for out of the Commodity Credit Corporation. So they've proposed this big market development effort. We think that's fantastic and certainly can help bolster the ag economy.
Through RAP, USDA is providing up to $300 million in funding in its first year to support projects that help exporters break into new markets and increase their market share in growth markets. U.S. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
That program is really designed to create market diversification for trade opportunities, focusing on non-traditional markets, as well as providing some additional resources specifically for specialty crop exports.
RAP funds are available to nonprofit U.S. agricultural trade organizations, nonprofit state regional trade groups, U.S. agricultural cooperatives, and state agencies that conduct approved market development activities to foster expanded exports and market diversification by encouraging the development, maintenance, and expansion of diverse commercial export markets for U.S. agricultural commodities and products.
The reason it's structured and designed this way is because it's important in order to utilize the Commodity Credit Corporation resources that it is distinguishable from the regular trade promotion programs.
Though he supports the program, Keel says more work is still needed.
But we also need to open new markets with trade agreements, with tariff reductions, really working government to government. And we need to see that kind of activity stepped up in 2024.
The new year will bring several dairy policy topics to the forefront. Chad Smith has more on some of the key dairy issues for 2024.
Many opportunities for change and improvement in U.S. dairy policy have been delayed until 2024 or are in the formal rulemaking process. Danny Munch, an economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation, says the Farm Bill extension has delayed work on some of the priorities.
Some of our dairy-related Farm Bill priorities are on the back burner. So this includes things like pricing-related adjustments we were looking for, like an authorization of a mandatory and audited survey of processor costs and yields, a switch back to the higher of class one mover and authorizing modified block voting, as well as some of our dairy margin coverage changes related to production history and tier one coverage limitations.
He says those conversations will continue when Congress is back in session next year. Also continuing next year are the federal milk marketing order hearings, which will resume in mid-January.
USDA will actually be reconvening the hearing yet again at 8 a.m. on January 16th, still in the same location in Carmel, Indiana. Once completed, there are still many other steps in this process. USDA will publish the transcript from everything that was said, thousands of pages. Parties can then file corrections to that transcript. Then parties will file post-hearing briefs or their final comments. Based on the transcripts, USDA will publish a recommended decision on the Federal Register. Parties can then comment on that, and then the USDA will issue a final decision, which farmers will then vote on in a referendum.
The final issue on the horizon for early 2024 is the Dairy Margin Coverage Program.
Dairy Margin Coverage enrollment has still not yet been reopened. I actually reached out to FSA, and they said language in the 2018 Farm Bill requires regulatory change that they have to publish in the Federal Register before they can actually hold the sign up. So there's a delay there. There's also some software updates they said they had to put in place first. So they don't have a date in mind yet, but said enrollment will occur. Once it does open, they say protection should be retroactive to any months that it's delayed through.
Keep up to date with these issues at FB.org. Chad Smith, Washington.
Iowa Republican Congressman Zach Nunn joined with Virginia Democrat Abigail Spanberger to introduce two pieces of legislation focused on conservation. The Streamlining Conservation Practices Act will strengthen the Natural Resources Conservation Service by providing for increased public input. Nunn says farmers are the best people to decide which conservation practices to use on their fields.
There are approximately 500,000 or half a million farmers across America who work to implement conservation practices, and a lot of innovation is really happening in the field, not at the USDA. We want to make sure that the best practices that are being determined in the field by farmers, by practitioners, by ranchers and growers are the things that are being reflected in the USDA, not the other way around. This is one of the areas we're going to work with to make sure that we can really tee up what is working for the farmer can become the standard for the rest of the country and help drive policy in D.C. versus waiting for D.C. to tell us what and how and when we should be planting in the field.
They also introduced the Conservation Innovation Act, which will establish the Office of Conservation Innovation within the USDA. He says it's not another layer of bureaucracy.
There's got to be an on-ramp for America's producers to be able to get their best information in front of USDA. Specifically with the Conservation Innovation Act, this office would work within the NRCS to ensure the utilization of the most effective technologies. We're talking about AI and machine learning that's being practiced in the field right now. During the revision of the current conservation standard to develop a new standard. So really, in the baseline level, we want to be able to get information into USDA versus USDA coming up with a standard and blasting that out.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just need to get the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for the AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, yield is already lost by the time a fungal infection is visible, but a company has figured out a way to let corn signal to farmers when it needs a fungicide application. David Geiger has this report.
If plants could talk, what would they say? Would they ask for help if they were stressed out? Well, a company is helping plants communicate that by changing color. Kyle Muller with Insignum AgTech.
From my perspective, I said, hey, we got to be able to listen from the plant's perspective. We got to give them the tools to tell us what they need.
That tool takes a naturally occurring pigment in a plant, right now that's purple in corn, and allows the plant to change to that color whenever it feels a fungal infection.
It fits very well into this concept around precision agriculture and around trying to use different pieces of tools to detect crop disease. I mean, it's a really tough problem to solve.
Moeller says this new way of watching for fungi can work even before the plant shows symptoms.
And it's really simple and straightforward to tell, right? It's not an expensive camera that you got to buy. It's not an algorithm that makes predictions. It's real and true, and you can see it with your own eyes because your plants are telling you they're turning color to signal that early infection.
And now Moeller says they'll be able to work even more on this tool. The USDA Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service gave the green light to run trials on corn plants developed by Insignum Ag.
Whether that's in test plots or in breeding stations, those kinds of things. And so we're really happy that the USDA saw that our technology is safe and just like a normal breeding process.
So far, Insignum Ag has been working on the Muller family farm in Indiana. Last year, they worked with Bex Hybrids. Now they have the okay from USDA.
So we're really excited to continue this collaboration with Bex and get started doing some testing across the Midwest so we can pick up some different environments, some different diseases, and really know what the breadth of this.
Such as expanding into crops like soybeans and canola, as well as having triggers for low fertility or insect attacks. Muller plans to license the genes and traits of the product to seed companies, and also hopes to work with other precision tech to quickly spot color changes. Ultimately, the point of the product is to get producers another way to stay ahead of damaging diseases.
When I started to talk to farmers really early about this concept, they said, look, my question is not which disease I have, it's do I need to spray or not? We designed this technology so that it reacts to every single fungal disease and specifically only the fungal diseases.
One thing Muller hopes to test now after the USDA decision is what happens to the color after fungicide applications, if it goes away or if a new growth will replace the previously infected parts. I'm David Geiger.
In other news, there is some talk of potential cranberry shortages in the U.S. heading into the holidays. Tom Lochner, executive director of the Wisconsin Cranberry Growers Association, says a cranberry shortage just in time for holiday season was news to him.
That's news to me. I know this year's crop here in Wisconsin was above what our expectations were, so we were in pretty good shape here in the Badger State. As far as fresh fruit supplies go, I'm not sure there was much of a Christmas pack this year, but there was a really good fresh fruit crop, so a lot of it did get set out for the Thanksgiving holiday, and people should be able to find supplies in their grocery stores, but I've not heard of a cranberry shortage this year, that's for sure.
Wisconsin is the number one cranberry producing state in the nation.
Wisconsin leads the world in cranberry production, and we account for about 60 to 65% of the U.S. crop every year. So it's a state's largest fruit crop, and again, we lead the nation in cranberry production by far.
There will be more than enough cranberries to last through the rest of the holidays and into the new year.
Fresh fruit is very seasonal. It only accounts for about 3% of the crop, but the other 97% of the crop is sold as processed products like dried cranberries, juice, cranberry sauce, and other processed products. And those should be in ample supply in the grocery stores for consumers throughout the holiday season and throughout the rest of the year.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with this livestock report.
In today's livestock news, federal regulation has created an interesting issue for owners of local livestock markets that could have an impact on livestock producers, whether through the sale ring by way of freezer beef or otherwise. Receiving top dollar for their product is the goal of livestock producers. Livestock Marketing Association Vice President of Government and Industry Affairs, Chelsea Good, shares more.
The livestock auctions I work with, we're really heavily regulated by the Packers and Stockyards Act. It's actually a law that was passed 102 years ago to deal with terminal stockyards, and our businesses have really changed over the years. We've got the auction method of selling and a lot more transparency, but yet some pieces of that law are still in place that are actually challenging and don't fit today's environment. I'll give you an example. It's actually illegal for a livestock auction owner to own or invest in a packing facility. So we've got some sale barn owners that have a local locker in their town that might not stay in business unless they buy it and make a go of it, and they're interested in doing that, and yet they've got the federal government telling them no. You know, we want more packing capacity. We've got all these incentives out there, but not you. Livestock auction owners, you can't participate in that.
LMA reasons that this law takes a local marketing option off the table for producers.
Absolutely, and we've seen that over the last couple of years where finding people to custom slaughter animals for freezer beef got really, really tight. And we just see that as, you know, one more thing that a producer might want to do to, add to their bottom line, and that's what we've got a heart for in the auctions. You know, we don't exist without good, profitable livestock producers, and so we're wanting to make sure that they've got every opportunity available to them, that they've got as much competition as possible, which is what the auction method does, and that's what we're trying to do here as well.
In other livestock news, the USDA's December cattle on feed report came out last Friday. Gary Crawford from USDA may have some good news for producers.
After several months of seeing pretty high numbers of cattle going into feedlots, placements during November dropped down from a year ago. Friday's USDA Cattle on Feed report has November placements down 2% from November last year. USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagham says this is not an unexpected thing, considering what producers have been dealing with for the last year.
Dry conditions, a poor wheat pasture, tight water supplies likely pushed a lot of cattle in earlier than normally would have occurred. And as you sort of move forward, the supplies that are available for placement later declined. And so that you are seeing, after we have seen periods of higher than expected placements, we are seeing the decline in placements, likely reflecting those tighter supplies of animals.
Which Shagham says will eventually mean even higher cattle and beef prices in 2024. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
The CoBank 2024 Outlook Report highlights the resilience of the U.S. economy amid recent shocks. However, there are some challenges looking ahead. While conventional economic indicators appear positive, consumers are increasingly affected by high prices for essentials, potentially leading to reduced spending, impacting the overall economy. The global economy is experiencing a shift from free trade to protectionism, contributing to a slowdown in growth. In the U.S., governing challenges with slim majorities in Congress delay crucial funding bills, including the Farm Bill. The agricultural sector faces hurdles with high production costs, though tight global inventories offer some upside price potential. Renewable diesel demand may impact soybean acreage, and the livestock sector's profitability may improve with lower feed costs. The dairy industry faces uncertainties in demand, with the CoBank report indicating that international factors are a wild card. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has announced that agricultural producers can now sign up for the Farm Service Agency's Agriculture Risk Coverage and Price Loss Coverage programs. FSA Administrator Zach Ducheneau explains how ARC and PLC coverage, enrollment, and election work.
Producers can elect to take three different types of coverage. They can enroll in ARC County or price loss coverage, which provides crop-by-crop protection, or they can choose ARC Individual or ARC IC, which protects the entire farm. And those election changes for 2024 are optional. Producers must enroll through a signed contract each year. However, if a producer has a multi-year contract on the farm, it'll continue through 2024 as it was unless they make an election change. But it's part of the overall safety net for covered commodities. It's a vital part of our safety net. And the way these payments are calculated is a year after the fact so that we can do a detailed analysis of market year average prices and get those finalized. So in 2022, folks that selected the ARC County option or the ARC IC option triggered payments in the amount of about $267 million to help them keep the farm in operation going for the next year.
A Stop QIP petition has officially been disqualified by CDFA Secretary Karen Ross. Last month, the Producer Review Board discussed a recently certified petition to terminate the quota implementation plan, and the PRB recommended submitting the petition as an industry referendum. However, recent information revealed that the particular petition was one of six alternative petitions simultaneously prepared in 2021, raising concerns about the process. The use of pre-printed dates, potentially inaccurate and off by 18 to 23 months, further complicated the issue. Despite the PRB's recommendation, the decision was made to disqualify the petition due to these inconsistencies. The industry was advised against using pre-printed signatures for clarity and authenticity, suggesting the submission of one petition at a time to avoid confusion. The California Department of Food and Agriculture is set to receive a substantial boost of $38 million from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for its innovative, resilient food systems infrastructure program. Aimed at fortifying the middle of the supply chain, the initiative focuses on supporting processing, aggregation, and distribution activities for domestic food and farm businesses. Eligibility for funding extends to agricultural producers, processors, nonprofit organizations, local government entities, tribal governments, and middle-of-the-supply-chain institutions. CDFA plans to fund projects that align with specific priorities, including those submitted directly by growers. Projects eligible for funding range from expanding processing capacities and acquiring specialized equipment to enhancing worker safety through technology adoption. More information about the initiative and how to apply can be found at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
The USDA is hiring. That's coming up on This Land of Ours.
Does this describe you and your hunt for an entry-level job?
I really want to work on climate change. I don't know how to get my foot in the door.
If that's you, listen up. The door of opportunity is opening. Claire Sierowski is with USDA's Rural Development Mission, working with energy programs, some of which help farmers install clean energy systems. And she says applications from producers for those programs have been setting records.
And so we need more people to help us administer these programs.
USDA has just posted job announcements, 40 positions under its Climate Change Fellows program, new positions opening up initially in 33 states and Puerto Rico.
And so these fellows will be basically working with the energy lead in their state and actually going through these applications from farmers and evaluating them, you know, with some training, of course, and then awarding these new projects.
For more information, go online, search Climate Fellows USDA. Climate Fellows USDA, application deadline January 9th. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back. The potential of our nation's sustainable aviation fuel industry received significant support recently from an announced federal fuel production credit. Rod Bain reports.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, known for his long-standing support of the bio-based industry and one sector in particular, sustainable aviation fuel. A common example about biofuel opportunities in several of his presentations over the years.
I get electric cars, battery wears out, pull aside of the road, pick up your cell phone, call a friend, get a charge, off you go. What if you're in a plane and you're flying over Great Lakes or the Pacific Ocean or the Atlantic Ocean. What do you do? Well, the reality is you're not going to be flying in a battery-powered plane. You're not going to be flying in a hydrogen-powered plane for a long, long time. You're going to be flying in a low-carbon fuel plane.
Recently, the Agriculture Department and other federal agencies have lent their support to expand sustainable aviation fuel production, capacity, and use. A measure announced in December is guidance provided by the Treasury Department and Internal Revenue Service regarding SAF credits and eligibility for such. Producers of biomass-based diesel, advanced and cellulosic biofuels, and cellulosic biodiesel, approved by the Environmental Protection Agency under the Renewable Fuel Standard, would be eligible for the credit. Secretary Vilsack is quick to point out what the credit and other incentives could potentially do from an economic perspective for the biofuel industry.
Sustainable aviation fuel is a 36 billion gallon industry that does not exist for all intents and purposes today. 36 billion gallons. Compare that to the existing biofuel industry. You're talking about twice the size of the existing industry today. If that industry supports 400,000 jobs, do the math. There's a tremendous opportunity just in sustainable aviation fuel.
In addition, USDA is among a group of federal agencies participating in an interagency working group studying the potential life cycle of sustainable aviation fuels. The existing model, called Greenhouse Gases, Regulated Emissions, and Energy Use and Technology, or GREET for short, has been modified in part to accept data and science involving aviation fuel. This allows for the Sustainable Aviation Fuel Credit. Among those in the biofuel and ag sector applauding the credit and its economic potential, Paul Winters of Clean Fuels Alliance America.
The first industry that's getting into sustainable aviation fuel. The process for making renewable diesel can be upgraded to make sustainable aviation fuel from the same feedstocks, same soybean oil, canola oil, recycled animal fats, used cooking oil. A lot of our industry is looking to make investments to upgrade facilities and begin production of sustainable aviation fuel.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
A new report indicates that hog producers are trying to raise prices by keeping a lid on output. Gary Crawford has more.
It appears the nation's hog producers are trying to keep a lid on production and get hog prices up by reducing farrowings and balancing that out with more pigs per litter.
That is largely what appears to be happening.
USDA livestock analyst Shale Shackham, he bases that on USDA's new quarterly hogs and pigs report. It shows farrowings down 4% in the September to November quarter, with pigs per litter up 4%. Producers also say they intend to cut farrowings this quarter by 2% and the next quarter by 1%.
Their returns have been weak. They've been looking at relatively low hog prices. We have seen declining corn prices, but for the most part, I think that they're looking at, you know, having seen hog prices that were at or below break even, and that's sort of conditioning them to pull in the reins on production.
And that is backed up by more than just the USDA numbers.
If we look at producer returns, Iowa State University measures farrow finished returns. And they have for this year, they have been negative since January, with the exception of just 2 months in July and August, with fairly sharp declines in October and November. So again, that is largely probably conditioning what producers were thinking in terms of, you know, not wanting to get too far ahead in terms of an expansion.
The report shows the breeding inventory December 1st down 3% from a year ago. The total hogs and pig inventory, 75 million head, up less than 1% from last year. USDA's most recent forecast for pork production projects pork output for 2024 will top this year by a small amount, about 1.5%. USDA projects hog prices will average $60 a hundredweight next year, up from this year by $1.30, but that's just 2% higher than 2023. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
We go to Chuck Zimmerman now to learn more about biologicals.
I'm visiting with Alex Cochran with DPH Biologicals. And first of all, Alex, tell us a little bit about DPH and why you're here at this ASTA conference.
Yeah, DPH Biologicals, we're a
basic manufacture biological technologies, both biofertility and biocontrol technologies. Our main interest here is we do have some seed treatment technologies that we're representing at this conference, and really excited to be back at ASTA. The opportunity to represent those technologies with interested parties, particularly seed companies.
So what do you think about now being called Field Crop Seed Convention instead of what those other letters were?
Yeah, I think it's a nice change. I mean, I think it represents the, obviously we have two different forums, one that focuses on vegetables, one that focuses on field crops, and this one, maybe it's a bit more descriptive of exactly what it was for those many years versus being more of a generic name.
So what's kind of like the message for folks that are here stopping by to see you?
The main message that we're going to be talking about is how biological technologies can complement complete seed recipes. That, while there's a lot of excellent chemistry out there, what we've seen and what I'll talk about specifically later on today, in fact, is that in an IPM strategy, biologicals can nicely complement those chemistries and provide protection against important pests, particularly Pythium, where we know we have some risks with chemistries in regards to resistance and sensitivity. That's been published by a number of universities across the Corn Belt. So in those situations, especially with planting, you get one opportunity to get that right, essentially, or have to contemplate replanting potentially. But putting everything you can on the seed to provide protection is really important, and biologicals can be an important part of that strategy.
Well, you have a booth here. Is there any other ways you're doing support for this conference at all? I know I saw a big old banner out there.
Yes, yeah, for sure. Certainly, advertising here at the conference. I'll be presenting as well, so, engaging in that way to communicate, some of this messaging around IPM and biological's role in that. Multiple interaction points.
All right. Well, it's great to see you here, and we hope you have a great conference. It's first time in Orlando, Florida. So here from the ASTA Field Crop Seed Convention, I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Now here's Ryan German with this week's Almond Update.
In this week's Almond Update from the Almond Board of California, outgoing president and CEO of the Almond Board, Richard Wacott, joined the Almond Journey podcast to reflect on the past 20 years of leading the Almond Board with Almond Journey podcast host Tim Hammerich.
I came to the Almond Board from private industry. I'd always been in agriculture and in food production, both B2B, business to business, as well as a stint with consumer products and consumer marketing. I'd always had an international career. So coming here into a nonprofit industry association, basically, even though we are a federal marketing order, we essentially operate like an industry association, was something new for me. And I, quite honestly, coming in, wasn't sure that this was for me. I mean, I love the product. I love the fact that we produced and still do over 80% of the world's supply in this valley. I love the international aspect of the business because that was something that I have always enjoyed and look forward to learning new markets and new applications in this business after I joined it. But it was a good fit, I thought, but I wasn't sure necessarily that the association management long term would be really where I'd want to stay. And now looking back 21 years, it's like, well, I guess I did want to stay. It was for me. And I think what made that longevity take place was the incredible growth curve that this industry went through over 20 years, tripling in size, and obviously all that brought with it in terms of the geographic expansion and the number of programs that we became involved in, the leadership we provided and provide to the tree nut industry and California agriculture in general, the leadership in the health space that clearly we were sort of pioneers in the nut world anyway, and all of the achievements in terms of winning over consumers around the world. So when as I look back, there were a couple of threshold moments in terms of achievements in the food safety arena and in the health arena. But I think mostly for me, it was a wealth of good people and solid family farms that I got to deal with over all these years, and an industry that really wanted to aspire, and a board of directors, fortunately for me, that also wanted to really, you know, go where no nut has gone before, sort of thing, right? And so that was really exciting to be part of and to provide the, you know, executive management that would take us there. So, yeah, it's been really a delight. I've thoroughly enjoyed the industry. I've enjoyed this position. I've enjoyed all the challenges that I've had both personally and professionally. And it's been a great ride, as they say.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned challenges there. Is there anything as you reflect on these past 20 years that stands out as a regret or anything you wish would have gone differently?
Well, I think we all can say that the current economic conditions of the industry are not the ones we desire. And it's unfortunate that we've had this dip, very unfortunate. And it's not for lack of a lot of effort. It's not for a lack of making a lot of right decisions. It's a lot of things that came together to not only take our industry economically to a level that is unsustainable, but has done so for a lot of the tree nuts, and we need to climb out of that. And I'm hoping that'll take place here sooner, much sooner than later. But no, I don't think there really that I have any big regrets. I think, you know, when we had challenges like the Salmonella incidents of 2001 and 2004. And we rallied as an industry, which wasn't easy. It was very difficult, actually, to earn, you know, the support and reach the decisions at the board level to pursue with the pasteurization program. Again, not easily done at all, but we did it. And we haven't had a Salmonella incident since then. We also did the same with some aflatoxin issues going into Europe. We still have some issue with that, but we largely mitigated it through our pre-export check program. So there are many examples of initiatives that the industry took to ensure that we could chart the course forward that we wanted to. And we did so in ways that other industries did not, and they suffered the consequences from that. So I'm proud and not regretful that we went through sort of the pain of deliberation and second guessing ourselves a bit whether this is the right thing to do for the industry, but ultimately doing it. And again, you know, history has proven that those were good choices that we made.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it sounds like you had to take multiple sort of unprecedented actions early in your tenure there. I mean, between the food safety and the health research, things like that. Are there any particular conversations or people that stand out as, you know, giving you advice early on when you were leading the Almond Board that really impacted the rest of your work there?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. First of all, yes, there have been individuals throughout my career here that I've looked to for their advice. One thing coming into this sort of position with this type of organization, you have, you know, today 7,600 growers that are contributing to the Almond Board of California financially, and, you know, many of those also with their personal time on our committees or the board of directors, et cetera. And you have different points of view, and you have different business models that handlers have for their clientele, and things that certain parts of the industry want to support and other parts of the industry don't. And so my viewpoint on all that was that, you know, most likely there's a position that's best for the industry. And best for the industry doesn't necessarily mean it's best for absolutely everybody, but it's best for the industry as a whole. And that's what I always strove to achieve and support it with science and sound thinking and logic. But at the same time, trying to inspire and create a vision for the industry where making those decisions in that way, would support that vision. And so I think we did a pretty good job of that over the years, not totally successful all the time, but that's was my approach. And with that, making sure that I surrounded myself with the best team that I possibly could. And I must say, I'm so pleased handing the reins over to Clarice with the team we have in place here at the Alma Board. They're just very highly motivated, very professional experts in their fields. And I think that's been to a large degree, part of the success of the board's programs and activities. And ultimately, the industry has been the team we have in place here. I've been able to rely on across all sorts of different issues that we deal with here. And it is very broad, the landscape of things we deal with here. It's largely due to that we've been as successful as we have.
Again, this was just a portion of the latest Almond Journey podcast. You can listen to the entire podcast and other episodes by searching Almond Journey wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you, Brian. And don't forget, you can also search for the Agnet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading apps and have the Agnet News Hour at your convenience. We will be right back. You are listening to the Agnet News Hour, and now for more news. Looking back on 2023, well above normal precipitation caused by a weather phenomenon created unusually wet conditions in California to start the year. Rod Bain has more.
What are the top weather stories in our country for 2023? USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey provides his list, including
the California flooding that actually started at the tail end of 2022, but carried well into March of 2023.
The flooding caused by a series of climatic conditions called atmospheric rivers.
That flooding included significant agricultural impacts, such as the return of Tulare Lake in the southern San Joaquin Valley, flooding over 100,000 acres of fertile agricultural land. The first reappearance of that former majestic lake since the 1997-98 wet season. That water, actually, some of it's still in place, even as we head into the winter of 2023-24.
Also of note, as a major weather event in 2023, a significant northeastern cold wave in what was a mild winter for much of the nation. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Developing animal handling skills, like all things, takes practice. And a researcher at the University of Wisconsin has developed an innovative, interactive way for dairy farmers and their employees to brush up on their handling techniques. Holstein USA's Bob Severa shares the story.
You might think someone's telling you the punchline of a joke when describing Dr. Jennifer Van Ossa's latest project in the dairy industry, but it's not. The project simply has a clever name.
A new educational resource that we have called Moving Cows. That's moving with two O's.
Dr. Van Oss is an assistant professor and extension specialist in animal welfare in the Department of Animal and Dairy Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her long title is intimidating, but her project is not.
It's a flight simulator essentially for cow handling. So you could call it an educational video game. It's an innovative educational resource so that people can practice cow handling skills in a simulated environment.
In real life, Dr. Van Ossa's project is no game. It was born out of extensive research on several farms to make animal handling the best it can be.
There were a few topics that kept coming up over and over, and one of them was people asking me if I could please come to their farm and train their employees on appropriate cow handling and cow movement practices.
As a solution to the requests, she created a way to make lessons interactive and show how a cow's natural personal bubble can be used to calmly move her to where she needs to go.
The game lets them practice by moving their character in relation to these simulated cows to see how the cows respond. And we also want them to learn from the game that your behavior towards the cows not just affects where they move, but also whether the cow experiences stress or fear. And we know that when cows are more stressed, they produce less milk, and they also can behave more unpredictably, which can be dangerous for you as a cow handler.
As exciting as developing the cow moving simulator has been, Dr. Van Oss acknowledges that still, nothing replaces real-life education.
This simulation can complement other types of training. So watching videos definitely still has a place. Nothing can ever replace real-life practice, but I think that this can add to that toolkit.
For Holstein Association USA, I'm Bob Cervera.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.